We're talking about variances in the Bible right now. And if you weren't here last week, we always back up a little bit. So this is, again, some of you have seen this. But it's important to understand, particularly the nature of these variants. Because when you do, you realize it's not that big of a deal. And it's not nearly as big of a deal as people want to make it out to be. So we look at the four kinds of variances that we have in the Bible. Those neither viable or meaningful. Those are differences in the manuscripts that you don't have to worry about at all. They give us no problem whatsoever. And as we said, they make up 70% of all of the variances. Those that are viable but not meaningful. We looked at the word John, the Greek word for John. You see the little what looks like a V, but actually is a nu in the Greek, the N sound. But there's two of them up here and one here, and that's a variance. So whenever you see that in the manuscript, that's people look at that. It's a different in manuscripts, and it is indeed. We don't know always if the original writer wrote, like, for example, in Acts 3 or wherever you see the word John. We can't always be sure, depending on the manuscript evidence. Again, if you had just one manuscript that spelt that Greek word with two nus instead of one, then you say, oh, it ought to be, we know it was one. But if there's a balance with the manuscripts, we have no idea. But it doesn't matter, does it? That's a difference in the manuscripts that it may be viable. There's a good chance that can go either way, but has no meaning whatsoever so far as our belief system goes or anything like that, the doctrine of Christ or our faith or anything. So those that are meaningful but not viable, we looked at one passage, Luke chapter 6 at verse 22, where we see there's at least one manuscript that discounts that, leaves off that last part. That changes the meaning just a little bit. But in this case, so far as I know with this, if I remember correctly, there's just one manuscript that has that. And so in that particular passage, then it's not viable. You wouldn't trust that the original said that when there's just one manuscript that has that particular reading. Then you have those that are meaningful and viable, and those are the ones that count. Those are the ones that we wish didn't exist, but they do. And we gave a few examples of that with John, where in some of the manuscripts it has a go, R, and then some your, and so again it's a different reading, and there's enough balance with the manuscripts to where those who are scholars with regard to this, the textual critics, they not sure about that particular passage. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It doesn't make a lot of difference there. You can interpret that in such a way that it would ultimately mean the same thing. But those are the places that we can't be sure. I should point this out to you. In fact, I think I have even I think I read this in a previous class with the ESV, and in your Bible it does the same thing. It always tells you the textual basis for your translation. And I'm trying to see. I was just reading some of this, here with its philosophy. Most of your translation will have in the very beginning. It will tell you the textual basis for it. What textual tradition that the translation is based upon, and then it'll also have a section like in here that has mine says translation philosophy, like the Living Bible will, it's a paraphrase, and while that's an okay translation to look at from time to time if you're just you just want to get a different view. But you realize when you're reading a paraphrase that that's exactly what it is. And it's not a word for word, and sometimes it can be way off. And then once in a while, a paraphrase like the Living Bible will say something just right, and But you have to be sharp enough in your own personal study where you know if it's just right. Like that really brings out what the original meant for it to say in a dramatic kind of way that would be worth reading. But a lot of times those paraphrase, they just take their own course. Like with the Living Bible, it has a habit of referring to faith only. Well, does the Bible teach faith only? No, but it's a paraphrase. So the ones who put that together believe in faith only, so they put faith only. Well, that's no good. And so you just have to be aware of that. Where most of the translations that we have some respect for, we all realize that all translations have their problems. We should realize that. And they're just translations. But the ones we really can trust are those who do their very best for a word-for-word translation of the original text. And so, here reading in the translation philosophy of the ESV, it says the ESV is an essentially literal translation that seeks as far as possible to capture the precise wording of the original text and the personal style of each Bible writer. Now, I'm reading this right now to you just for this particular purpose. I don't want to shock you, and I don't want you to go running out of here. But you notice even as it's worded. Now, this is known to be a very reliable, it's kind of a new translation, comparatively speaking. But almost everyone you read, any textual critic, any scholar on the New Testament text will affirm to you the ESV is a real good translation. But even here, you notice how this read, that we seek as far as possible to capture the precise wording of the original text. Now, I'm saying all this to tell you, there are places where we can't be sure of what the original text is. And in translation, a translation is a translation. You hear the old saying, something's lost in translation. Well, that's right. And when you go from Greek to English, in some places, something is lost. And in some places, we have these variants, and we have places like with something that with what you have on the screen where we cannot be absolutely sure of what the original said. And so, I mean, we need to understand that we know God inspired his word, and whatever he wanted the apostles and the associates of the apostles to write, they wrote. And the whole purpose of this class is to help you to understand that we can have a lot of confidence in the fact that we have what the apostles wrote, that we have God's will, exactly what God wants us to do, how he wants us to live, how he wants us to worship. We have it. But there's a small percentage of places in the Bible where we can't be sure what the original said. And if you say, yes, we can, you just sound silly. And it gets to a point where you don't want to find yourself taking a position where everybody knows you're just wrong about that. And like if I were to stand before you and say, no, we know exactly every word that is in our English Bibles, we know that was in the original text. People who really make a living out of this, textual critics, would just shrug that off. But then you go to an extreme, like some of the quotes that we have put up here, where people say, we can't rely on the Bible. Yes, we can. Because as we go through all of this, and some of you who maybe you weren't here last week, we gave some other example. These are just examples, again, meaningful, viable, but they don't change our faith even a little bit. And so... Even this fellow that we've been talking about a little bit, he's become an enemy of the Bible, really. But even he says, in misquoting Jesus, essentially, essential Christian beliefs are not affected by textual variants in the manuscript tradition of the New Testament. Even he has to admit that. And then the point, you'll remember this if you're here last week, but if you weren't, this is the thing. Of all that I was saying right now, and why the ESV says, as far as possible, they're going for a word-for-word translation of the original text. They want in the ESV a translation, of course, so it's not the Greek, you know. I mean, you'd have to, we can't read Greek most of it. So, but But they're going for a word-for-word translation. But even they say, as far as possible. Because they realize that there's places where they can't. But look, that's 1% of the variances. 1%. Like, it's so tiny, it doesn't matter. And so if anyone tells you, oh, the Bible can't be trusted, and we don't know, look at all the mistakes. 1% fall into the category of being viable and meaningful. And even those don't have anything to do with our faith. Like the ones we put up there, they, even when they're meaningful and viable, they change the text just slightly. And it's a good possibility that there's a difference in the original that we can't be sure about. Even with that 1%, they never, ever, ever, ever affect anything that has to do with our faith or the doctrine of Christ or the will of God or anything like that. Ever. There is no such thing in the Bible as a variant that affects our faith. It doesn't exist. And individuals like to say, I'm not planning to do a lesson on this, but maybe I should, on, you know, this. You have the variants. Then you have the places in the Bible where people believe the Bible contradicts itself. The Bible never contradicts itself, ever. And through the years, all the enemies of the Bible, they have tried to come up with things. They set things forth, but never have they been able to come up with a contradiction that is real, that can't be answered. Now, you know, sometimes they'll throw things out and you say, I got to think about that. And I'm going to do some research, but they've never been able to successfully prove the Bible in any place, Old or New Testament, in any place contradicts itself, ever. And that's the thing that we need to hang our hat on, that's faith building, to realize that all through the years, the most popular book in the world, the most printed book in history, no one can find a contradiction in it that can stand. And so that's wonderful. But there are variants. And 1% of them are meaningful and viable, but they never change our faith. So we start looking at three variants that you probably should know of. And then really there's four, because Rick Barnes had to tell me another one. So, and so now, one of them is it's not challenged at all. What is the one that talks about the witnesses, three witnesses? I think it's 1 John 5, maybe, is it? Whatever it is, I can't remember. I don't think it's 1 John. I can't remember what it is, but it talks about the three bearing witness. And I don't know of any serious scholar who has ever suggested that should be in the original text. Like, everybody knows a scribe put that in. It is a variant, though. And so, but Rick reminded me of one that is a little bit more significant to us. But let's just start with this Mark 16:9-20. And we went through, again, if you weren't here, I just went through rather quickly. Obviously, we're not looking at any of these passages, but what I'm showing up here is that everything in those 12 verses can be found in different places in the Bible. So if we were just to say, okay, I don't even feel like arguing, let's just say Mark 16:9-20 shouldn't be in our Bible. What's the effect of that? Again, nothing. Because there's nothing taught in those verses that's not taught in other places. And so I'm just putting up on the screen all of these various aspects of that particular passage, the appearance to Mary Magdalene, Mary's report to the other disciples, the unbelief of the disciples, Jesus' appearance to the two on their way to Emmaus, the Jesus' appearance to the 11. These are all things that appear in those 12 verses. But we can go to other places and see them as well. Almost everything in that text. The only thing that is not, I don't believe, is found anywhere else, is the Let's see. Somehow that looks like I didn't copy that right, did it? Pick it up of scorpions there. Why do I have that up there again? Pick it up of serpents. Miracle. Okay, I don't see it there. Do you see where in Mark there it talks about if you drink poison, you can drink poison and won't be hurt by it, right? Remember that? Did you see that up there? Well, I don't even see it up there. You know what that is? That's a variant. Just joking. But anyway, in Mark 9 somewhere in there, it talks about they'd be able to drink poison and wouldn't hurt them. And so far as I know, that's not stated anywhere else in the Bible. Only in Mark 9. But everything else in that entire passage can be seen in other places. And when you think about that, I mean, that a lot of that idea of drinking poison and not being hurt by it would be covered by the miraculous element of this passage anyway. So it's not a big deal at all. But the point of it is everything in there. And that's why Dave Miller here, he's a part of this website that I think we talked about it before, that it's a very good website that you should check out. I think many of you have. But he says most, if not all, scholars who have examined the subject concede that the truths presented in the verses, and this is what I want you to get, are historically authentic. And so what he means by that is it doesn't contradict anything in history at all with regard. He's not saying there that it should be in the Bible. He's not saying that. But he's saying all the scholars look at that and know that it's historically authentic. Even if they reject the genuineness of the verses as being original part of Mark's account, the verses contain no teaching of significance that is not taught elsewhere. And again, I don't know of any scholar. I've not come across anyone, and I've read a whole lot on all of this textual stuff. I've not read anyone who disagrees with that, who wouldn't claim that it was historically authentic, even if it wasn't in the original writings. Everything happened, what's said in the text happened. All right, well, very quickly, before we look at whether or not we should accept it, there's four endings to the book of Mark that we have manuscripts of. And the first two are the obvious ones, that omits those verses and then one that includes it. But then you also have some manuscripts that include it with additional statements between verse 8 and 9. And those statements, we have the manuscript, the statement between 8 and 9 says, but they reported briefly to Peter and those with him all that they had been told. And after this, Jesus himself sent out by means of them from east to west the sacred and imperishable proclamation of eternal salvation. So we have extant manuscripts that have that in between verse 8 and 9. And then we have another ending of Mark that has some additional statements between verses 14 and 15. And I can't remember someone, it may have been Greg, but someone came to me in his Bible that actually has that, at least a note of it. Or does it have the whole thing written out? Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Right. Well, they may have gotten that wrong. And just goes to show you, again, that's just man who's writing that. But if I got what you just said, Greg, right, they act like this particular statement is sometimes found between 8 and 9 and sometimes between 14 and 15. If that's what it's saying, they're wrong about that. It's a whole different statement there. Here's what you see between 14 and 15. It's a longer statement. And they excuse themselves saying this age of lawlessness and unbelief is under Satan, who does not allow the truth and power of God to prevail over the unclean things of the spirit, or does not allow what lies under the unclean spirits to understand the truth and power of God more in order that they may inherit the spiritual incorruptible glory of righteousness, which is in heaven. That's what's between 14 and 15 in some manuscripts. Now, so there are actually two different statements between those verses. But again, almost everyone, probably unanimously, I couldn't say that for sure, but almost everyone rejects those two endings. Like nobody, they're not viable, in other words. I think the one between 8 and 9 only appears in one manuscript. And then the, or that may, I can't remember now. That may be this one. That only appears in one manuscript. But I think it is 4. But the third ending isn't much better than 4. There's just not a whole lot of weight to it, so that no scholar believes that that was, those statements were a part of the original text. But the point of it is, we have 4 different endings to Mark. And the only ones that really matter are the ones that omit it and the ones that include it that are viable. And so, yeah, go ahead, Greg. Yes, yes. Well, yeah, between, now that, yeah, right, yes, yes. But, don't confuse me with the facts here. But the point of it is, there's these 4 endings that you actually have. But this is one of those cases where you look at the manuscripts, nobody takes these endings of 3 and 4 seriously, because they're just not enough proof. You wouldn't trust. And that just that reemphasizes what this whole business is all about, what the textual critic is able to do. There's so many manuscripts that they have the ability to look at and say, no, we're not buying that. And because they just don't appear in enough manuscript. It's when there's a lot of weight, where there's a, you know, they appear in later manuscripts and earlier manuscripts and the papyrus sometimes and the uncials, and then now they really have to dig to see, to try to figure out which is right. And they usually can do that, except for 1% of the time. So, go ahead, Paul. Right.
I'm not sure it's the number one read book of all time.
Right.
I'm sure
right.
A lot of people that have Bibles in their home that's never read them.
Right.
But,
yeah.
You know, if it's supposed to be so false, why is it the number one seller?
Well, things are changing. The world is changing. And over the years, people have had a lot of confidence in the Bible. Now, there have always been Bible critics and things. But things are, attitudes towards the Bible is changing. And that's, again, one of the purposes of this class, because there's a lot of people now who are not only, well, not quite sure about the Bible, but have gone to that to think, you believe the Bible's literal? You know, you're one of those ignorant kind of people? Really? I mean, they think that we're just foolish for accepting. Like most liberals today will think that. Again, I'm not getting political or anything like that, but that was the very comment that Obama made, President Obama made, when he was dealing with homosexuality. Like he brought up the passages in the Old Testament that talk about stoning, and viewed that, and he, you know, we know enough about President Obama that he had a religious background. You know, I think he was a part of the United Church of Christ, which is a big problem. But still, he had a religious background. And if you were to ask him, he'd say he believes in God and believes in the Bible and all of that. But as he was talking about that Old Testament text, he viewed it as, really, who can buy that? Like, there's no way. And he's not alone in that. How many people in our society today do you think would say, really? The opening of the Red Sea? Now, the Bible's great. Now, we need to use it, but you don't have to believe every story in it. The virgin birth, really? And I mean, you think of all of the different things you read in the Bible, and there's a lot of people, the supernatural element of it in our society today, who outright reject it and think you're foolish for even believing, you're not supposed to take the Bible literally. Only a few fanatics do that, and they're dead wrong. See, so, but the truth is, the Bible is inspired, which means it's all from God. Every story in it is real and historic. And but people's attitude is changing towards the Bible. Now, just working this back in, that's why it's important these variances, all the ones we're looking at, including Mark. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter what position you take on March 16th. Like, they're good, and I'm not talking about liberal scholars now, but they're good conservative scholars that come down on both sides of this. In fact, the majority of scholarship rejects those verses, 9 through 20. It is the overwhelming consensus amongst textual critics that those verses don't belong there. And we're not talking about a bunch of nuts. We're not talking about a bunch of liberals. We're talking about very conservative Bible scholars in the realm of textual criticism. They may be way out there theologically, whatever, you know. But so far as textual, the New Testament text is concerned, they're very, very conservative and believe in a word-for-word translation, and that we can get back very, very close to the original, all of that. They're very conservative, but they reject that. They reject these verses. And so at the end of the day, because of what I just had on the screen, nothing in that passage can't be taught or isn't taught in other places. But it is interesting. You need to know about it because these are the kind of things, all, you know, this many verses. One thing to say, well, you know, that some places they spelt the word John differently. You can kind of shrug that off. But when people open up their Bible and they see that some translations have this and other translations are missing 12 verses, they say, I think these people are right. The Bible is corrupt. No, it's not. It's not. So just being aware of this, then you can at least, when someone brings it up to you, you can discuss it in an intelligent way and know. So just quickly, we'll not spend a lot of time on it, but the omission of it. Why do some people believe? Why do all these scholars who are conservative conclude that these verses don't belong in the Bible, that they're not in the original? First of all, they're not included in the Vaticanus and Sciaticus. Remember, those are two of the best witnesses we have for the New Testament. Two of the three great uncels. And they're not, they don't contain that particular section. Now, I'll have more to say about that here after a while, but that's not to be taken lightly. Again, those are powerful witnesses. We rely on those two codices very much. And Mark 16, 9 through 20 isn't in either one of them. And so when you come across some of these modern translations, they have the passage in there, but they usually have it in brackets or something, and they'll have a note to let you know the two oldest Greek manuscripts and some other authorities omit from 9 to the end. And the New American Standard has a note in there. The NIV, both the early one and the latest translation, the ESV, some of the earliest manuscripts do not include it. They're very quick to point that out because they realize how important those two manuscripts are. And it's a part of the textual tradition of all of those translations. And so they put it in there, but they put it in brackets. Here's a fella. This, I don't know if you've ever seen this, gotquestions.org. That's a pretty good website if you're looking up things like this. But if this gets your attention, say, you know, gotquestions.org, I like to have some questions answered. I'm going to go to that website. Don't ever go to that website for anything doctrinal, ever. I can't do that. he's a nut. I mean, when it comes down to doctrine, he's an evangelical, faith-only, Calvinistic premillennialist. And he'll give you all the wrong answers to almost everything. But he's pretty good when it comes down to questions that have to do with the Bible and things. But here, he doesn't believe that these verses should be in the Bible. So he's kind of with the majority of textual critics. He says, but notice what he bases it on. The Gospel of Mark ends at verse 8 and two of the oldest, most respected manuscripts. And gives them, as the oldest manuscripts are known to be the most accurate and the oldest manuscripts do not contain verses 9 through 20. We can conclude that these verses were added later by scribes. So he basically, because they're not in those two powerhouse manuscripts, he concludes it wasn't in the original text. So that just goes to show you how important textual critics rely, how much they rely on some of those earlier manuscripts. And so not to be taken lightly, very quickly, the absence from the various versions. We looked at some of those in past lessons, and Mark 16, 9 through 20 is missing in a lot of them. Some of the patristic writers, the so-called church fathers, don't acknowledge them. Clement of Alexandria and Origen show no knowledge of the existence of these verses. Furthermore, Eusebius and Jerome attest that the passages was absent from almost all Greek copies of Mark known to them. So what I'm giving you is the reason why textual critics don't believe that these verses were in the original text. That's what they call the external evidence. Then they have internal evidence that looks at the text itself, and many of them say the vocabulary and the style are non-Markian. In other words, they're quick to point out that in those verses, at least 17 times, I think one source said 18, but at least 17 times, there are words or phrases that you don't read anywhere else in the book of Mark in those 12 verses. So they conclude that means someone else, a scribe, wrote that, not Mark, because the vocabulary and the style is not Mark. And so that's their evidence. And then the transition between 8 and 9 is abrupt and awkward, they conclude. This same fellow said the Greek word translated now that begins verse 9 should link it to what follows, as the use of the word now does in the other synoptic gospels. However, what follows doesn't continue the story of the women referred to in verse 8, describing instead Jesus appearing to Mary Magdalene. So he believes the transition between 8 and 9 is awkward and obviously added later. So that's his conclusion to it. Now, we won't have time to get to it, let's quickly look at the inclusion of Mark. I believe that those verses should be there. And so it puts me in the minority, of course, but I think they should. They're contained in the majority of manuscripts. So they're missing in the early manuscripts. But a lot of the later manuscripts have them, like by a lot. And we understand right away, you know already from what we have studied so far, that alone doesn't settle the issue. Like it's not a vote on number and how many. And so it doesn't work like that. But sometimes when there's just so many manuscripts that contain them, then at least you have to give pause to think it could be authentic, even if the earliest don't have them. And so here, Kurt and Barbara Alland, and these are two very important. If you look into textual criticism and things, you'll read of the Nestle Alland text. It is what all of our modern translations are based. It's the Greek text our translations, like the ESV American Standard, is based on. And these are the editors of it. And so, I mean, they know what they're talking about. And now they reject those verses. But they say this: it is true that the longer ending of Mark 16, 9 through 11 is found in 99% of the Greek manuscripts, as well as the rest of the tradition, enjoying over a period of centuries practically an official ecclesiastical sanction as a genuine part of the Gospel of Mark. So they reject it. on the basis that you can't find it in the Vaticanus and Sinaiticus codices, but they admit, boy, it has enjoyed a long tradition, and in 99% of the Greek manuscripts, they are found. And Dave Miller, again, on the basis of their quote, he says, such longstanding and widespread acceptance cannot be treated lightly or dismissed easily. It is at least possible that the prevalence of manuscript support for the verses is due to their genuineness. So most manuscripts have the text in it. These are some of the very powerhouse manuscripts. Alexandrinus, remember, that's the third of the great codices. And so there, Alexandria is on par with the other two that we've mentioned, really. Only reason why it's listed third is because it's a 5th century instead of a 4th century. But the text is pure, just like the other ones, and it has Mark 16, verses 9 through 20 in it, as well as these other ones. Was that the first bell or second bell? That was the second bell? Really? Well, look, here is the Vaticanus over there. What's interesting is we said that Mark doesn't appear in those manuscripts. But what is interesting is, look, they got a blank spot. Why? Why in the world do they have a blank spot? This one, it picks up with the next, right? But this is where Mark 16, 9 through 20 is supposed to be. But it's not there. But is a blank spot. And that's very unusual. In fact, we don't have that anywhere else in any other manuscript, which tells you that the scribes involved in that believe something goes there. And I believe it's Mark 16, 9 through 20. That goes there. But it's blank. And so that's a head scratcher there. All right, so we'll pick up there next week.